The American POTUS Podcast is a 501c3 nonprofit show supported by listener patriots just like you. To help us keep the program going, please join others around the nation by considering a tax-deductible donation. You can make your contribution and see what exciting plans we have for new podcasts and other outreach programs at AmericanPOTUS.org. Thank you for your support, and we hope you enjoy this episode. On this episode of American POTUS, the first to raise his hand and take the oath, George Washington. When this national hero reluctantly took the job, he quickly realized he wasn't just a figurehead. He had to figure out what exactly the presidency was. So like any good leader, he recruited some of the country's best and brightest to help him. And while they didn't always get along, they did create a brand new, uniquely American executive branch that is still somewhat familiar today. POTUS number one, and the men and women who helped him create the presidency, next on American POTUS. I'm Scott Brunn with the National Museum of American Presidents. With the help of presidential scholar Alan Lowe, we're opening the book on the men who have held our nation's highest office. In each episode, we'll tap into our nationwide cabinet of historians, authors, experts, and others to reveal the most compelling moments from these extraordinary patriots. We're thrilled to have as our guest experts on POTUS number one, David and Jeannie Heidler. They were both history teachers for many years. Jeannie, most recently, is a history professor at the United States Air Force Academy. They've written several critically acclaimed books about the early years of our country, including Washington Circle, The Creation of the President. David and Jeannie, thanks for taking the time to talk about Washington and those early, early years of the presidency. Welcome to American POTUS.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
It certainly is. Thank you so much.
Jeannie and David, I'm excited to have you here. And I want to start out, you've written so many wonderful books about the history of our nation. What led to your passion for history? And why do you think a knowledge of history is important?
I think that history is important because it offers us a tether to the past that grounds us in the present. And from that allows us a rational way to plan for the future. You know, Chesterton remarked on what he called the democracy of the dead, which was his rationale for the importance of tradition in human affairs, and that the refusal to submit to what he called the small and arrogant oligarchy of people who just happen to be here at the moment is wrong, because democracy no more disqualifies a person from having a voice because of the accident of his birth, and that we shouldn't disqualify anyone from having a voice on the basis of the accident of his death. And as a result, we have a respect for the past and the people who lived it. Take it on its own terms and judge people fairly and tolerantly for the tribulations that they experience, the ordeals that they survive, and the way they muddle through, the way all of us do, in any circumstance where you don't know the future and at least can have a sense of the past. And so history has a value in that.
And I also think that today we talk a lot about culture and how important it is to understand other people's culture. And I don't think that's possible if you don't understand their history. And so I think that not just our history, but world history, that we need to be aware of what happened before, because that there really isn't a way that we can understand a modern culture without understanding that culture's past.
Yeah, without history, there is no perspective. So, and I love the tether to the past to ground you in the present and plan for the future. That's a wonderful statement of the importance of history. So with that, let's jump to POTUS number one and George Washington. And in Washington Circle, you place a focus on those around the president, how that circle of men and women supported and helped build the man and the leader. Let's start with some general questions about how President Washington managed. What was he like as a boss? Was he a good communicator? Was he a micromanager? How did he handle those around him?
Well, you know, Washington's management style developed during the war, during the Revolutionary War, in which he regularly held councils of his senior officers, his closest associates, his official family. And in that, he would seek a broad range of opinions and from that derive a conclusive judgment. That was his alone. He wanted to work from an informed position, and as a consequence, never moved forward without consultation. And in fact, his attitude toward his secretaries at the various departments in the executive was a counsel. He regarded them as a group of counselors whose advice would help direct the affairs of the constitutional government. They didn't even call it the cabinet until 1793, I think, because it was a notion that a cabinet was more monarchical. It was sort of like a parliamentary prime ministership with an executive operating in a monarchical system, and that was very unpopular for obvious reasons. So the expectations within that system were that, as it was in the war, that there would be candor and cooperation, that opinions would be honest and sincere. They would be offered in a congenial way, in an environment that was civil. And once he made the decision, it was expected that the matter was resolved and everyone would move forward as one after having had their say. And when that did not happen, it at first baffled him, and then it exasperated him. Jeannie probably can say why as much as I can.
Well, I think he thought, I mean, to use a modern phrase, that when the government started, that everyone was on the same page, mm-hmm. that they wanted the same thing. And it did puzzle him when, fairly early on, it emerged that wasn't necessarily the case. And you mentioned him as a communicator, and that was in some ways part of the problem. Washington was not a great communicator in the sense that he was not a great speaker. And so in these meetings, he became concerned, but was not really able to express his concern in a way that really impressed itself on the people, particularly Jefferson and Hamilton, as they became more and more at loggerheads.
I know he had a bad temper, right, that he kept under control typically. Would that ever emerge in these cabinet meetings, particularly when you started seeing the fights between Jefferson and Hamilton?
You know, I think, in fact, what he did tried to do, he tried to have these meetings occur in an environment that would discourage confrontation. He took to having them at home, have them scheduled so as to break and have a meal, a luncheon usually, where the family, his real family, would join the official family, in an idea that this sort of setting would blunt the animosities and lead to a more social mm-hmm. arrangement than an official one. So his temper, while legendary and unleashed, formidable, was usually under check. I think probably the main problem was that the personalities between Jefferson and Hamilton were so much at odds, mm-hmm. as well as their philosophies, that they were bound to clash because of temperament and philosophy. And they tended to recruit colleagues to their sides, and then the cliquish nature of the cabinet made it something of an ordeal, with people posturing and putting out ploys and demanding, you know, the decisions be made or forestalled. And the diminishing congeniality that began to border on incivility in those forced him to go to written opinions. He stopped having meetings and would have them simply submit to him written opinions. He was never able to rein in his two-star performers there, the arguably the most talented people who ever served in the executive branch, mm-hmm. Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, simply couldn't get along with each other.
And add to that mix James Madison, who was perhaps his closest confidant, at least at the beginning, but then essentially goes into the Jefferson camp as those camps develop. When these debates started, and Washington saw these divisions, he saw the kind of lack of civility that was starting to happen. How did that affect his views of those men personally? Did he remain friends with them? Were they still close, or did he feel betrayed as he saw these other camps springing up to oppose what he was trying to do in concert with Alexander Hamilton?
I don't think he ever lost his fondness for James Madison. They had similar interests. He did consult him less and less as the administration proceeded, but I think he remained fond of him as a person. You know, he never really was that personally close to Thomas Jefferson.
I see.
They had not consulted with one another during the revolution. I mean, they traveled in different circles. Mm-hmm. And so I think he liked him at first, but it wasn't a matter of an estrangement of a close friend, mm-hmm. As it would have been. He had some amount of difficulty with Henry Knox toward the end mm-hmm. of Knox's tenure. So in some ways it did, but it wasn't something that was earth-shattering, you know, in other words, a complete break.
Yeah, Jefferson, the only real personal interaction that Jefferson and Washington had before Jefferson came into the State Department was a somewhat awkward interview in which Washington asked Jefferson his opinion on the Society of Cincinnati that had been Henry Knox's idea. It was a sort of a fraternal notion of hereditary society of brother officers from the war. Jefferson found this very troubling. He said it was a bad idea on a lot of different ways. And he told Washington that quite candidly. And Washington did not take umbrage at it, but it was the kind of thing that Washington would remember. Mm-hmm. And it speaks volumes about his ability to put aside personal piques to bring Jefferson into his official family after an encounter like that. Mm-hmm. James Madison was quite insistent on Jefferson for state, and Washington was listening to Madison quite diligently at that time. And as a result, Jefferson was brought in, but they weren't close. We all know, unfortunately, that never developed, and it went rather sour after Jefferson left the administration. Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine going back in time, though, to one of those early cabinet meetings with Washington, Jefferson, and Madison all sitting around the same table? Pretty amazing to think about.
Well, yeah, it would be. And, you know, the interesting thing about those meetings, Alan, is that Jefferson never or Washington never looked at departments as mutually exclusive. They were not discrete divisions, for instance. The mm-hmm. bailiwicks did not limit opinions. And this irked Hamilton and Jefferson both no end, that Washington was perfectly prepared to take Jefferson's advice on matters dealing with the economy and perfectly willing to take Hamilton's advice on foreign relations. And both of them thought that was poaching when that happened. And that was another source of difficulty. I think it's one of the reasons that Jefferson rather became impatient with Washington and then rather disenchanted with it, that he thought he was falling under Hamilton's sway and as a result was not altogether complimentary in his assessments of Washington after he left the administration.
Now, you both mentioned Henry Knox. I think he's obviously not nearly as well known. What can you tell us about this really interesting man and his relationship with General and then President Washington?
Well, you know, Knox was something of an intellectual before the war. He was a bookseller, read very widely. It's one of the reasons that he became pretty adept at artillery work, because he was a member of some artillery clubs and was interested in heavy ordnance and had practical experience too. But Washington, one of the people who was very friendliest to Washington when he arrived in Boston to take command of the Continental Army from Artemus Ward, there was a problem in there. There were a lot of people in the circle there, the military circle, who found Washington to be something of an interloper and were prepared to take exception to him on that basis alone, that he was a Virginian upselling Massachusetts men, New England men, what to do. And Knox never did that. He took Washington immediately on his own terms and was highly complimentary of him, not in public, to Lucy, his wife. He told him that Washington is a wonderful man, fills the rooms with dignity. And then Knox pulled off one of the premier exploits of the war by going up and getting the cannon at Ticonderoga and bringing them across some of the most daunting terrain in the world, in the worst weather in the world, and giving them to Washington and Boston. That march in 1776, allowed them to run the British out of Boston and in the occupation. Washington never forgot that. It never mattered that Henry Knox became portly and even obese and lumbering and kind of slow-witted and by all appearances. to him, Knox never took off the uniform. He was there at the beginning. He was there at the end, all the times in between, good and bad. And when Washington looked at Henry Knox, he saw an American hero.
Within this circle, Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton, Knox, others, of course you have Martha, perhaps the closest, obviously, as his wife and our first lady. You acknowledge that relationship is shrouded in a bit of mystery, but it was definitely a successful partnership. Can you talk a bit about how that partnership worked? And then to the extent you can you comment on it? Was it just a partnership or also a marriage of love and passion?
Part of the problem, as you know, is that most of their letters were destroyed, that Martha intentionally, after his death, burned most of their correspondence. There are a couple of letters that survived, apparently by accident. And so we don't, even though they spent a good bit of their marriage apart, particularly during the war, we don't know what they said to each other in writing. We get a hint of it from those two letters that survived, that this was not a marriage of convenience, that they truly, deeply loved one another. As far as the passion goes, we have no way of knowing. I'm sure that when they were young married, that there was probably a lot more passion than during the presidency. But there's really no way to know that. All we have really are the observations of other people. And I think probably one of the most poignant came after Washington's death, when the wife of the British minister, her name was Henrietta Liston, when she went to visit Martha at Mount Vernon before the Listons went back to Great Britain. And she had always thought that their marriage was more of a companionship, that's really how she would have described it, until she saw Martha for the first time after his death, and she observed that as she called Martha, this excellent woman was grieving incessantly, that she was a completely different person now that he was dead. And I think in some ways that tells us a great deal about their love for one another.
Yeah, you know the story of the desk, Alan, the desk that Washington actually sold to Eliza Powell when they were leaving Philadelphia to go home after he was retiring, and he was getting rid of furniture that he didn't want and taking, and the desk, she wrote him a note saying that she had discovered a packet of letters from an ardent lover in the desk and wanted to return them, and it turned out she was joshing him a bit. They were love letters that he had written to Martha. And she had kept them, and they had wound up in that desk somehow or other, tied up in a ribbon. Whether Eliza read any of those or not, it's hard to say, but she probably saw more of the inside relationship, the innards of that relationship, than any other living person by virtue of those that correspondence. And that was among the stuff, apparently, that Martha Washington destroyed. She didn't want any of that to go public.
What I wouldn't give to see those letters. That would be amazing to have.
Really, yeah. All of
it. We're going to talk about some of the men and women in Washington's unofficial circle in just a moment. But first, we want to hear from you. Let us know what you think of this episode or any of the others. Also, do you have an episode idea or an author you think would be interesting? Drop us a line at AmericanPotus.com. Or visit one of our social pages on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.
Let's go to another person in Washington's circle, Lafayette, an amazing man in and of himself. So much has been written about Lafayette and about the relationship with Washington that seemed to be akin to almost a father-son relationship. How do you think Lafayette affected Washington's personality, and what boxes did they check for each other that led to such an intense and very long-lasting friendship?
Well, you know, when Washington met Lafayette, it was in 1777, and it was the summer, and he had a dinner party, and Lafayette was there, and Washington's heart sank. He didn't like him very much upon first meeting him, because he knew that he was one of those foreign officers that Congress was in the habit of giving commissions to, and much to the chagrin of his regular staff. But over the space of 2.5-3 hours at that dinner party, something happened, and it's ineffable. You can't really put your finger on it, but something happened, and between those two men, that if that young man, he was quite young, he wasn't even 20 when all of this first began. This young man had grown up in Mount Vernon under Washington's eyes. It wouldn't have made any difference. It would have been the same. He was like a son and became more and more so, and developed a real affection. There was something about their personalities that meshed. Lafayette was not subservient or fawning, but he was respectful and eager and sincere, completely sincere in everything he did. And Washington found in that something so refreshing and so endearing that I don't think another person in the world touched him as much as that kid did that night and in the months that followed.
I know when Lafayette was jailed during the French Revolution, did not Washington try to help obtain his release?
He did the best he could. He was concerned as president of appearing to interfere in internal French affairs. But he did, behind the scenes, he did as much as he possibly could. And he did take care of, after his presidency, he did take care of George Washington Lafayette, Lafayette's son, at Mount Vernon. Until his father was freed from the Austrian prison he ended up in.
And then Lafayette comes to America after that, right? After Washington's death, Lafayette comes to America and tours around and goes to the tomb, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that was in 1824, and he was quite elderly and somewhat infirm by then. Was given a hero's welcome wherever he went. It was a grand tour, in fact. And he went to the tomb, you're right, at Mount Vernon. And all the companions had enough sense to back away and leave him alone and not cluster around with him. And he wept.
So moving on to other people in Washington's circle, you very interestingly include two men and one woman enslaved at Mount Vernon, William Lee Hercules and Oney Judge. You use those troubling relationships to talk about Washington and slavery, a topic that's been much discussed in present day, and you say that Washington simply did not want to talk about. He hated slavery for moral and economic reasons, but like many founders would say, he didn't know how to do away with it. How did he square the institution of slavery with the principles of the nation he was helping to found?
I think he had a lot of trouble with that. I think it is something he struggled with from the Revolution on until the end of his life. And those three people, who are three, you know, very different examples of Washington's relationship to slavery, do show how difficult it was. Hercules, who of course was the fabulous cook, you could even call him a chef, who ended up leaving and disappearing. Washington, I don't think, ever really understood Hercules in the pride that he took in his work and his abilities, and I think, and he was mistreated, not so much by Washington, except maybe by neglect, but by white overseers, and I think that damage to his pride is the primary reason he left. He could have left when he was in Philadelphia, but he waited until he was sent back to Mount Vernon toward the end of Washington's presidency to disappear. And Washington never tried to find him. I mean, there's no evidence. He didn't put out ads, didn't send out slave catchers. He essentially let him go. Oney Judge is another issue altogether. She was Martha's personal maid. Martha had essentially brought her up from childhood, was very fond of her. And I think Martha saw Oney Judge's escape to freedom as a personal affront, because she felt that she had always treated her well. There was also the complication. He did try to find Oney. I mean, he went to tremendous lengths to find Oney, perhaps partly because of Martha being hurt by Oney's disappearance, but also there was a financial issue Oney belonged to the Custis estate. She did not belong to Washington. And as a result, if she was not recaptured, which she was not, he would have to reimburse the estate. So she was going to cost him money. And that's something Washington was always very concerned about, because he was always short of ready cash. So I think those two and their different circumstances show the complexity of Washington's, not only his views on slavery, but his relationship with slavery. And I'll let David talk a little bit about William Lee, because that's another case altogether.
Yeah, well, you know, and Jeannie's right. The thing with the situation with the Oney judge is that, in truth, Martha did not own any of her slaves. They were held in trust within the Custis estate and would revert to the Custis estate upon her death. And this became a nightmare because they all intermarried at Mount Vernon, and it was impossible to determine, you know, who was who and what, where the financial burdens would lay. And so it was incredibly complicated, as well as morally repugnant. The William Lee, Washington came into the possession of William Lee quite early, and when he was a young man, teenager, and he became a Washington's factotum. In fact, he was with him throughout the Revolution, his right-hand man, and was given incredible amounts of trust and duty for things that required a great deal of initiative and volition after the war. And he got hurt. He hurt himself on two occasions. His legs became so badly injured that he was no longer ambulatory and couldn't work as he had. And so Washington had him, kept him as a cobbler on the Mount Vernon estate. There is an interesting division in their relationship. At a certain point, and when Lee reaches a certain age, he becomes, he was always Billy, and he becomes William. In all of the correspondence and all of the references to him, he is William Lee rather than Billy. And that was a mark of respect for Washington. He did not settle that on a whole lot of people, white or black, which indicates a kind of importance that is borne out in the will, where he Lee is the second person mentioned in the will after Martha. And to settle upon him a stipend, an annual stipend, and he's free. He's free by Martha's volition when she was willing to do it or died. But he was to receive the annual stipend to make him financially independent for the rest of his days.
So now I'm going to turn to some more general questions about President Washington. I'm going to start with asking a very unfair question. What was his single greatest achievement?
Oh, you know, Jeannie and I have talked about this ever since we started the, and you know what we finally did? We finally came to the conclusion, and yeah, Jeannie might have a different idea as well, but the main conclusion was that he went home. Those were his greatest achievements. He did that twice. He went home at the end of the Revolution, and he went home at the end of the presidency. And he did these things quite willingly, enthusiastically, in fact, which was the setting aside of power. In the case of the Revolution, incredible power with a group of armed men thoroughly devoted to him. Mm-hmm. He handed that group of armed men over to the civil authorities and went home. And he did the same thing later. And the fact that he did those things made it possible to make him president, because everyone was sure that he wasn't going to be a king, and that when the time came, he would leave, that he knew not only when to make his entrance, but when it was time to make an exit. And I think that probably had as much to do with the success of the Revolution and the success of the Republic as anything else he did.
And that's so rare in history. You see so many republics fail because the men in charge don't have that kind of character that they want. Once they have power, they want to keep it. And Washington, thankfully, exactly. Was not that person. What about his greatest failure?
I think probably his actions in the early phases of the French and Indian War, when he was still a very young man. I think it's also a good, his behavior, his immaturity, his carelessness, his lack of gratitude for those people who helped him get where he was. All of those things were failures that were going to do more than anything else. They were going to illustrate that people sometimes are most improved by their failures, because he did improve and learn from his mistake.
Now, I've always been amazed at the change that happened in Washington. He changed from a young man, if I remember correctly, who wanted a career in the British military, British Navy, to being the man who led the revolution against the king. He helped fire the first shot of the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, and then he became the bane of the British Army just a few years later. How did that change occur, and occur so quickly?
Well, you know, you've got to count a couple of things that we've already referred to, and one of them is Martha. I think she was a remarkably salutary settling influence on George Washington. The responsibilities that she brought into his life with the two children, and her as at the center of that. And then the environment that she helped to create at Mount Vernon, where he was expected to run a successful, viable farming operation in a very competitive and difficult environment, that fight the elements as well as the parasites like the Hessian fly, you know, and was quite innovative in doing so. In the course of his time, that was seed time for Washington, between the vaulting ambition of the French and Indian War, and then the advent of the Revolution, so that baked him, and he was ready. He was ready for the challenge, as it turned out, when the time came.
And I think too that his attitude about the British changed for logical reasons. First of all, the British had not treated him terribly well during the French and Indian War. I mean, he had been promised, at least on two occasions, a regular commission. Neither one of them came about. And then when he saw the British treating the colonies in much the way they had treated him, I think his attitude evolved rather logically.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Alan, it's another thing. It just occurred to me, in fact, and we mentioned it before, but I remembered. You know, the accident of his father's death, when it happened, had a great deal to do with this, coincidentally, because his father died and left the family in somewhat straitened circumstances, Washington wasn't sent abroad. He wasn't sent to Britain the way his half-brothers were to be educated. And so he was never given the opportunity to be exposed to Britain as home. And as a result, grew up without those kinds of physical ties to the mother country that the rest of his family had.
Very interesting. You mentioned earlier his kind of constant need for ready cash. And do you think that the economic ties he had with the mother country, which were difficult for him at times in terms of feeling subservient and not getting the right prices for products and so forth, is that something that helped turn him against the British as well?
Yes, I definitely do. I mean, it was one of the primary reasons why he converted Mount Vernon's farms from tobacco production to grain, particularly wheat, so that he would have a local market for his product. He, like all planters in the colonies, had to sell their products, tobacco in his case, to the British, and then buy the manufactured goods from Great Britain at their prices. And that's one of the reasons so many of them were always short of cash. But once he had a local market for his products, particularly the grains, but then he also became a very good distiller and could sell whiskey. Particularly rye, I believe, was the primary product, then he had a source of cash that he did not have to depend on the British for.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you both spoke earlier about his giving up command at the end of the Revolution, his returning home after the presidency, but one other really important action that isn't given as much attention, I believe, is the Newburgh conspiracy. Can you perhaps tell our listeners a bit about what the Newburgh conspiracy was?
The Newburgh was the center of a significant discontent in the Army, especially in the upper echelons of it, much to Washington's horror. His senior people were apparently, it's not even called a plot or a conspiracy, he was quite open about everything. They were speaking ill of the government and gradually moving toward a pamphleteering program that was gaining momentum and attracting adherents. The idea that the government had neglected the Army to the extent that the Army should do something about it. There's some dispute about how dire and actual this was. Some historians think it was a grand piece of play acting on everyone's part to convince decentralists in the Continental Congress of the need for a more central government that would bear fruit in the constitutional movement. Who knows? I mean, we know as much about Newburgh as we'll ever know. I don't think, barring the emergence of new documentation. But what happened was that Washington was quite alarmed by this, whether by design or by some sort of stagecraft. He did make an appearance in March of 1783 at Newburgh during an officers' conclave where they were purportedly planning something serious to overthrow Congress and establish government under some sort of a strong man on horseback. Washington was rumored if he would accept it. And he appeared before these people and tried to calm them down. When the war started, he was 43, redheaded, strapping, confident, a physical specimen of note, and he looked so very old by 1783. He was past mid-century. The war had done terrible things to him. Although he was remarkably healthy to it, it had aged him awfully. And so they were all ashamed of themselves. And that alone seems to have completely disintegrated whatever momentum the Newburgh conspiracy had to overthrow the government. We've always thought that this was a bookend to something that he did very early in the war, when there was a rumor of a conspiracy in his own presidential guard in New York when they were setting off of in the summer of independence, when they were sitting off awaiting the British invasion. And it was the Thomas Hickey conspiracy is what it's called. But it was supposedly implicating Tories, the government, the city government in New York. And there was an opportunity for the revolution to go very wrong at its outset from this, that if there had been some sort of a tribunal set up to try people within the existing colonial government on the basis of what they were planning to do other than what they had done, is one of the ways revolutions can go wrong. Mm-hmm. So Washington was quite careful about this. He had Hickey hanged because that was a matter of military hygiene. But at the same time, he sent all of these people suspected of being in the pay of the enemy, and David Matthews, the mayor of New York, he sent them to New England. He got them out of town, quite literally, to a place where they couldn't be found on the notion that they would stand trial eventually, a trial that never happened. Washington never pressed it. And eventually these people just sort of go away. There were 13 of them, and they just simply sort of vanish, either into the British camp or just meld back into the American landscape. And that, at the outset of the Revolution, was one of Washington's finest hours that we think is a bookend to the Newburgh event, which is at the end of it. And in both instances, he saves it. He saves the Revolution.
So after the Revolution, after the presidency, he's at Mount Vernon. Mount Vernon is an amazing place to visit. I encourage everyone to go if you haven't. If you have been, go back again. It's easy to see why he loved it there. How do you think that beautiful home and that beautiful estate shaped and supported him?
Well, it it was a world that he had created and where he could be himself, where he could surround himself with his family, his friends, visitors. And after the presidency, he really could be himself. And I mentioned Henrietta Liston earlier, and she's a good example of that. When she and her husband came to visit him and Martha after he had left the presidency, she was shocked at the change in him, because they had attended, you know, many dinners at the presidential house in Philadelphia and had seen the more formal side of Washington, which he almost wore a mask as president. And then at Mount Vernon, he was a completely different person. He was relaxed, told jokes, he laughed at other people's jokes. He was, again, another person.
Mm-hmm.
And being at Mount Vernon in those few years that he had after the presidency, I think were the happiest years of his life.
So he's been called the indispensable man. Is that true?
Yes, definitely. Without him, there's no United States of America.
I fully agree with that. You can think about the other characters. There are other giants in our history around him, but none like Washington. We're very lucky he was where he was when he was.
Agreed. I think you're exactly right on that. And Jeannie and I don't think, have a bit of disagreement in that. Washington, without him, there's no revolution leading to a successful close and no constitutional republic getting its start. So, yes.
David and Jeannie, we'd like to give our listeners a bit of a glimpse into the personal side of POTUS number one with a few short questions. Here we go. Of the 43 presidents that followed him, who do you think his favorite would be?
I think Abraham Lincoln. In fact, I can't think of anyone else he would have approved of.
It's a very good choice. It is.
there might have been some things that Lincoln did that he wouldn't have approved of. But I think because Lincoln preserved what he had created, not just in the presidency, but really establishing the nation, I think he would have by far been his favorite. David?
Yeah, I think Lincoln definitely his favorite. Maybe Calvin Coolidge, close second.
Oh, there you go. And, you know, Lincoln revered the founders. He looked back to them for inspiration, for guidance. So that's an excellent choice by President Washington.
So granted, he did not like the idea of political parties. We know that. But if he were alive today, would he be a Republican or a Democrat?
Oh, I don't think that's answerable. I don't think he would be either.
He'd be like, no, thank you.
He did not like political parties for the very reason that they are so so regarded with such cynicism today, that the entire operation of the government, he thought, should be one of congenial agreement, that whatever disagreements arose should be handled in ways that were governed by principle rather than policy. And party reverses that. It governs by policy rather than principle.
What title meant the most to him, General Washington or President Washington?
A general. Even Martha called him General Washington during the presidency and afterwards. I think that that he was most proud of that. And it's somewhat interesting. It occurs to me that other presidents who had been generals, oftentimes that was their preferred.
Yeah.
Form of address, that they wanted to be called general rather than president. I'm not sure why, but it is true.
Isn't it on Andrew Jackson's tomb as General Andrew Jackson, not president?
That's true. Mm-hmm.
He was known to be an athletic man, most notably an excellent horseman. If he were alive today, what would be some of his favorite sports?
Well, polo probably comes to mind. Anything to do with horses and spectator sport, horse racing, definitely. He was an aficionado of that. What do you think, Jeannie?
I think he would have been very puzzled by a lot of our sports today.
Yeah, I do.
Although, you know, something else that comes to mind is target shooting. Mm-hmm. He would probably find to be interesting. Yeah.
So obviously there was no Secret Service back then, but what would have been his Secret Service code name?
I say Chief.
Chief. Yeah, that's perfect.
How about Dancer?
Well, he was an avid dancer.
What would you say his most impressive non-presidential skill was? Maybe it was dancing. Maybe we just answered that.
You might have a point there. Well, I think Mount Vernon. I think husbandry and agriculture. Mm-hmm. He was a scientific agricultural. He was in correspondence with some of the leading agricultural experts and agronomists of his day, and had really novel ideas that made Mount Vernon a paying proposition when it shouldn't have been. He's given a bad rap about Mount Vernon not being successful. It was a pretty good working farm under his management. And so, yeah, I think probably the farming would be it.
So after a long day with presidential cabinet meetings, with the arguing between Hamilton and Jefferson, what did he do for fun? How did he unwind?
He spent time with his family and friends, that they would sit around in the evening, and he would read newspapers and read aloud from the newspapers. Other people in the family would read sometimes from books. He loved to listen to granddaughter Nellie Custis play the piano. So I think just sitting around with those closest to him was how he unwound in the evening.
And finally, for each of you, what's your favorite quote of his?
Well, you know, he wrote, it was a general observation. It was a specific observation about espionage during the war. But I think as a general observation, it's quite telling. He wrote Robert Howe, his British counterpart in 1779. Few men have virtue to withstand the highest bidder.
That's true.
I like one that he was actually from his Newburgh speech, his prepared remarks that he made to the officers at Newburgh, when he said, "Freedom of speech may be taken away, then dumb and silent we may be led like sheep to the slaughter."
I love that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, Jeannie and David, this has been so great. Thank you so much for joining us and talking about an amazing man. I hope you will join us again in the future on American POTUS. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Alan. It's been a lot of fun. Appreciate it.
The American POTUS podcast is produced by the National Museum of American Presidents. Graphic design by the Thought Bureau. An original music score by Jonathan Clark Music. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, you can always send us a note at AmericanPOTUS.com or stop by our social pages on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Finally, it's our presidential last word from George Washington. Quote, "I hope I shall possess firmness and virtue enough to maintain what I consider the most enviable of all titles, the character of an honest man."